Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. Coming up in just one moment, we'll be talking about college admissions reliance on SAT and ACT scores. Should there be such a reliance? We'll talk about that. It should be a really good conversation. That's coming up momentarily. I do want to remind you, because I'm looking at Katie Madsen, who answers these phone calls. She's on air producing for us today. And we want to let you know that we're having a live broadcast very close to the election. So it should be an exciting broadcast. It is already an exciting election we've been covering for 2 years now. This will be at Marquette University. Our special guest, Mike Goucher, who I worked with many years ago and really knows, follows, and analyzes politics, will have the first hour of our broadcast, a panel of guests from both major political parties. The second hour, Marquette students and you, if you join us in the audience, will be talking about what's happening to get the vote out and what your thoughts are about this presidential race. So it's Thursday, October 30th, if you want to mark it down, from 9 a.m. until 11 a.m. at the Marquette University Alumni Memorial Union. And you don't have to pay. The admission is free, but we do ask that you register, and you can call this number to register, 414-227-2047, 414-227-2047, and we'd love to see you there. It should be a lot of fun. Well, this hour of the show, you probably have read about this, particularly if you have college-age students or you're thinking about college in your family. There were 5,500 college admissions officials and high school guidance counselors gathering last weekend in Seattle, where they looked at a number of issues. But the centerpiece of all of this was the first public presentation of the findings of the study of the use of standardized tests in undergraduate admission. There was a commission convened by some of the country's most influential college admissions officials, and it was headed by William Fitzsimmons from Harvard University, dean of admissions there. A year-long study it was, and what they found is that there are a growing number of colleges, like Lawrence University in Wisconsin, who have made the SAT and ACT optional. And the report concludes that more institutions could make admissions decisions without requiring the SAT and ACT, that it might be better to look at how students do on different kinds of tests and look specifically at how they're doing in high school courses. We're going to talk about this issue, and I think we'll have a great deal of response to it. Steve Syverson is joining us, and he is the vice president for enrollment at Lawrence University in Wisconsin. A little bit later in the show, we hope to track down the director of public policy for the National Association for College Admission Counseling, but the phone is not being answered right now, so we'll see how things go during this hour. Steve Syverson is joining us now, though. Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. We've already got a lot of phone lines going, so there's great interest in the topic. Tell me about the decision that was made at Lawrence to make SAT, ACT optional. Was it a big decision, a long decision in the making?
It was one that we thought about for quite a while, and we had a new president coming on board, so we wanted to wait till she was on board, make sure she was on board with going test optional, too, before we did it. It's an interesting one because there's lots of folks who are uneasy about it to begin with, and then as they start to really understand how it's used and some of the issues related to the test, they become more and more comfortable with it. Math and science faculty in particular are questioning at the beginning because they believe those numbers, you know, whatever those numbers are, because they have such important meaning in math and science. And when they start looking at these and understanding how it really relates to what we're trying to do in the admission process, they get more and more comfortable and become advocates of being test optional.
Interesting. When did you go test optional, Steve?
3 years ago, and actually we made the announcement and the decision to do it at the same time that the SAT was introducing their new writing component, where they went from being two tests or two components of their test to being three components.
Is this, I would imagine that certainly the tests were around when I went to college, which was a long time ago now. Do you think that we take these tests partially because we've always taken these tests, that we don't even think twice about, of course you have to take these tests as part of the admission process. We've always done it.
Well, and that's one of the interesting aspects of this. We haven't always done it. We've been doing it since about the 1940s.
Oh, my.
And so many colleges like Lawrence and the schools on the East Coast have been around for a century or so before the tests were ever available. So clearly, college admissions is not dependent on these tests. This mm-hmm. was really a move that came out of kind of the World War II testing of actually armed forces in terms of trying to figure out placements of where they would be best served in the armed forces. And then we started looking at doing more standardized testing of other folks. And I think now we perhaps are on a watershed moment where we're moving on perhaps beyond this in some ways as you get folks advocating things like creative and emotional intelligences and other kinds of intelligences that may correlate just as well with, how well you do ultimately down the line.
Mm-hmm. But how do you measure those, creative and emotional intelligence? Isn't that hard?
We haven't solved that yet.
Right, I'm sure.
In many ways, over the years, I've said if I had a test that could tell me about academic motivation and study skills or time management skills,
yes.
that I would take over anything else. And to a great extent, that's what a high school transcript does for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what you're saying in that regard. Your long paper was given, or presentation was given, to a number of college admissions officials and high school guidance counselors last weekend in Seattle. And from what I've read about this, they seem to be quite enthusiastic about looking at this again, that maybe this shouldn't be as big a part of the admission process. Did you get that sense?
Well, clearly, we started out in a room with 400 seats when we were about to do the presentation. They scurried us off then into a ballroom, and we had about 1,300 of the people show up for this. So it's the largest presentation ever
of
this kind of a thing at our conference. Clearly, there's a lot of angst and enthusiasm and energy and concern and all different kinds of things. And one of the really interesting things about this commission, there were about, 15 of us who were members of the commission, coming from a variety of kinds of backgrounds, a variety of kinds of schools, and everyone came in with some real concerns that they wanted addressed about these tests, not just whether colleges should be test optional, but this is a very complex issue with lots of things going on. And what was interesting is that I think almost every one of the 15 had a different issue that they were most concerned about. Mm. So it made for just the most stimulating kind of discussion.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
I think one of the concerns I have right now about the report is it's very multifaceted. It's lengthy. There are lots of things out there. And, the media tends to pick up on one or two of those things as you need to simplify it. And whether or not we should use tests in the admission process or become test optional like Lawrence is one small segment of it. We're more concerned broadly, not that these tests somehow have lost validity or things like that. There are issues related to, the disparity between those who have access to test prep courses and those who don't. And are we creating a bifurcation between the haves and the have-nots that wasn't as true back when you and I took the test? You took the test once, you got a good night's sleep the night before. It wasn't this big societal moment in time that you were going to take these tests and take them several times and things. But that's really changed for a lot of students now, and these 17-year-olds are too stressed out with the college admission process already. And so that's part of the question we're really asking is the value, these tests have value, is the value gained by them worth the trade-off in terms of some of the negatives that are spinning off?
Interesting. And what is the value of the tests?
The value helps to predict, or it correlates with, the grades at the end of the freshman year.
Mm.
Basically, that's the strongest correlation. Too often, as we talk about it, we talk about them correlating with, quote, success in college. And the commission actually has a segment there that challenges that we say, success in college. Someone could go through and get a 2.5 GPA and have an absolutely successful experience, fabulous leadership involvement, all kinds of great engagement with their college. And so to equate success in college with who had the highest grade point average is a dangerous sort of thought. And we're trying to broaden that definition of success and say, these tests only correlate with one little tiny piece, which is the end of the freshman year. In fact, at Lawrence, we're on a three-term system, and if you look at the correlation with the grades at the end of the first term, the grades at the end of the second term, and the grades at the end of the third term, even in the course of just the freshman year, you're seeing the correlation with these tests drop off dramatically at each of those three points.
Oh, that's interesting.
So we're really talking about kind of how quickly, the first start in college, more than whether you graduate, what your long-term success is. And yet, our society has come to see these as being much more important than that. And, you know, a high test score really is telling you lots more than it actually tells you.
Right. I didn't realize, I'm not sure why, but the extent of preparation for these. And you're right, there must be a huge divide between those who have and those who have not, because I'm sure it's not cheap to get tutors for these tests and to go to classes. And from some of the reports in the New York Times, some students are starting as early as seventh grade to get special tutors for the tests.
Yes. And this test prep industry is now $1 billion.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, just prepping for these tests. And again, part of it is the language. I've got a thing sitting here from the Princeton Review here in front of me that says, better scores, better choices. You know, it may be more choices, but the assumption is that it always is going to move you into some better realm. And when you get preoccupied with that, you're focusing on, for instance, the selectivity issue of the colleges, not what's the good match for you in terms of the colleges.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of what this commission was formed for. Is we just were really concerned about what's happening and the values that people are accepting because of these. The tests are not bad, but we're not sure they're worth what they're perpetuating on these kids.
Right. Let's welcome phone calls. We'll do that in just a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. And our guest is Steve Syverson, Vice President for Enrollment at Lawrence University, which is located, of course, in Wisconsin. He's been Dean of Admissions and Financial Aid since 1983. He served also as Director of Admissions at Pomona College in Claremont, California, and served as Vice President of the National Association for College Admission Counseling for Admission Practices, and was Chair of the Admission Practices Committee for the Western ACAC. He's a native of California, but has been living in Appleton for the past 25 years, and is proud that his daughter is now an alumna of Lawrence. So join our conversation. I'm sure that you have had experiences with ACT or SAT. It goes back so many years. You've had your own experiences, or you've had experiences with your children preparing for these tests or taking these tests. What do you think about the question of the hour, of course, is whether or not the test should be optional? What are the benefits and what are the problems with both of these tests? We certainly welcome your thoughts. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, Maya Angelou will be with us. She has a new book, Letter to My Daughter. We had an interview with her perhaps about a year ago, and she's just has an extraordinary presence and is so remarkably kind and smart, and it'll be a treat. So that's tomorrow during this hour. Steve Syverson is with us now, Vice President for Enrollment, Lawrence University in Wisconsin. Our number 800-486-8655, and Frank from Madison is our first caller. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
Fascinating topic. Very good guest. I'd like to make a very brief narrative. I was a member of a small group of students in a system which had the equivalent of state boards. We had junior matriculations, which you had to pass to get into university. And we were given a unique opportunity at the time, which was to take the Scholastic Aptitude Test. Several of us did so. And half of us were doing it in our second language. And all of those of us who did, being students of what was considered, I think, accurately a second-rate high school, were in the top 5th percent. And then we took our matriculations the same year, and at most we were in the top quartile. And what is interesting here is that our approach to the SATs were to eliminate the illogical categories. Basically, you didn't need to know very much about the subject, although to write our matriculations we had to write essays and solve problems. You could pretty much, if you didn't know anything, choose the only logical solution choice. And so I think it was a very primitive way of assessing ability. And it was unfortunately adopted in later years by the system that produced us. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Frank. Steve?
That's actually interesting because I think the tests probably have evolved a lot since then, but that's part of when these test prep companies work with students, that's one of the things they teach is sort of test-taking strategy. How, if you really don't know what the answer is, how can you eliminate a couple of the choices so that you've at least improved the chances that you've gotten it right? And there are some very specific test-taking strategies. And again, that's the concern. If you're someone who gets exposed to those and improve your test scores because of that, has it really measured something that's helpful long-term,
right,
in terms of your educational attainment or in terms of assessing that?
And it's supposed to improve your score by what percentage point? Do we know that?
Well, yeah, and that was interesting. A couple of people on the commission went into the commission desperately hoping that we could review the literature and be able to say, test prep doesn't work. Don't do it. Don't spend the money, and that we could get that word out there. When we reviewed the literature, we weren't able to come away with that conclusion, and our report cites that probably a typical increase on the SAT, at least, would be 20 to 30 points. There isn't a lot of good research on the ACT, and so we didn't come out with a statement about that. The test prep companies, on the other hand, will talk about 100-point improvement, which starts sounding a lot more significant, but all the validity studies that have been done by them are done by them, and they have
right.
a certain bias, you know, in terms
right.
of what they want the outcome to be. So it's hard to gauge, and we've actually commissioned a larger study to try to review all the literature that's out there, because test prep means lots of different things. It may mean someone taking a student aside for 3 days before the SAT or the ACT on Saturday and working with them in the evening for an hour, or it may mean somebody working with some student on a one-to-one basis over a period of years. So it ranges, and obviously the more you do of it, the more likely it is to improve your scores. If I have just a second.
Oh, of course.
We have a couple of extraordinarily good selective colleges up in Maine, Bates and Bowdoin College. Both have been test optional for more than 20 years. And these are highly selective liberal arts colleges. They published a couple of years ago a study, which was helpful to us in terms of becoming test optional, in which they reviewed the results of those 20 years of experience of being test optional. They collect scores from everyone, because most everyone still takes the test. They collect them after the student has enrolled, even if they chose not to have it included in their admission process. And the difference between the submitters, those who sent in scores for the admission process, and the non-submitters, those who asked that their scores not be included, the difference on the SAT was 90 points lower on the verbal and 70 points lower on the math. So 160 points lower on the old two-component SAT. So a substantially lower average score for the non-submitters. But over the 20 years, the difference in graduation rate from Bates was 0.1% between the submitters and the non-submitters. And the difference in the average GPA of those graduating between the two groups was 0.05. So it would be like the difference between a 3.60 and a 3.65. So you're talking about no difference.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are just non-existent differences. And yet they had 160 points lower. So clearly, it doesn't mean that the test doesn't add value, but clearly in a holistic admission process where you're reading all the material and paying attention to it, you can make perfectly good decisions even in the absence of those tests. And often those students are the ones who have the higher creative intelligence or some of these other kinds of intelligences. You can figure that out. You can't put necessarily a label on it, but you can figure that out. You can figure out who's going to be successful.
Right. Let's go to Don from Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Don.
Hey, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I'm driving. I'm safe, but I got to
okay.
But, you know, both my kids took one took the SAT, the other took the ACT because it was a high-pressure game. And I had to call because I had an interesting offer. I was in the labor pool a couple of months ago. I'm employed now from Abu Dhabi for asking me to come there and teach students on how to take the SAT.
Oh, my.
I was like, wow. This is interesting. And I got two of those calls in the span of 6 months. That's the same place from both from overseas, one from an Arab country.
Huh.
And I'm thinking these guys have saturated the market here, and maybe they're looking to make more money outside the United States. And that's my thing. And my assessment of this is is it because my curiosity or the question I would have is it because it's easier to assess these numeric tests? Because at the end of this ACT, SAT, you get a number. Because I've been a teacher for 21 years, it's very difficult to assess creative intelligence or emotional intelligence. It's not that easy. Performance-based assessment is very difficult. Is that why most of us are kind of leaning toward that? Tell me a number that tells you what you are and who you are. And is this why we are buying into this? Or my last question is, has anybody looked into whether Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or Stephen Hawking have taken this test? You get my point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got your point. Steve?
I don't know whether they have taken the test. That's an interesting question. Part of what happened was early on, the tests were adopted because, for instance, you were in an era where the New England schools, the Ivies and places like that, the vast majority of their students came from prep schools. You know, a much lower percentage of people even completed high school back in the earlier days, and a very low percentage went on to college. And so those really elite schools were administering their own tests, but they were focused primarily on the same set of students every year coming from a very select group of schools. They wanted to broaden their diversity in terms of where they were getting students from, and they wouldn't know about schools in Appleton, Wisconsin, you know, public school up here. So this test allowed, it was a leveling field. It allowed you to pick out someone from a small school off in the Midwest or out west where you didn't know about them and to say, whoa, those are great scores. This student probably has lots of potential. And so it was a way that they were able to broaden who they were able to admit to their institutions. And that worked really well, and I think it served a great purpose for a long period of time. What's happening now, we're afraid, is that because of test prep and because of the focus on this now, the intense focus on testing as being such a big part of the admission process, you're losing that advantage because you're now getting a group of elite haves, as the kids who went to the boarding schools back in the earlier part of the last century. They were from elite families, upper echelon socioeconomic groups, and you didn't find the kids who were just attending a public school, et cetera. Now you're again moving back into this process where the students who are attending the most affluent, elite kinds of high schools and who also have the affluence in their families to do test prep and that their schools focus on it, they're starting to move away again to where their test scores are separating from students in less affluent, less privileged kinds of environments. So in a sense, the very thing that it helped to do initially, it's starting to not help to do anymore.
Thanks, John, very much for the call. Let's go next to Charlie from Madison. Hi, Charlie.
Good morning, Steve and Kathleen. As one who didn't take the test way back when I was in high school and pretty quickly moved into an apprenticeship, and after 4 years in an apprenticeship and then a couple years working in the trade, I discovered that I'd learned a lot more in those 4 years than I had in many of the others. And I'm wondering if, you know, I wonder if there's some testing or some kind of channeling or somehow people could, you know, have the experience perhaps that I had of after 4 years saying, boy, you know, now I kind of know more. I know what I'd like to do. And that would be the time that a higher education could get a hold of people and perhaps even do more with them than you could fresh out of high school.
I think a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah, I think that actually an awful lot of colleges and universities, certainly within our profession, there's a great deal of discussion of what we refer to as non-traditional students, you know, students who are already out in the workforce and are coming back, people who have already had families and have now discovered that they're excited about moving in some new direction. And I don't know that it has so much to do with the testing, but I think there is a clear push of recognizing kind of lifetime learning and the fact that you don't have to go to college straight out of high school. And many, many parents that we interview, actually, after looking at all the wonderful resources at an institution, now will look at their son or daughter and say, look, you go work for 4 years. I'm going to come back to college because I'll take advantage of it.
Thanks very much for the call. We have an email, Steve. SAT and ACT are the only gender-neutral measurements of learning and knowledge. Both boys and girls score equally on tests. By reducing further the reliance on SAT and ACT, the percentage of males graduating from college will decline even further.
Very interesting. I got an email from someone, or a president did, and I need to respond to it, asking that same question, speculating in the same way. I think, actually, for a lot of years, there was a concern that women didn't score as well as men on the tests, and women are one of the groups that feel that the tests are slightly biased against them. We've actually, within our test optional group, turns out that we enroll a higher percentage of males who chose to be test optional than the females who chose to do that as well. So in our population, being test optional is probably actually enhancing the number of males who are enrolling at Lawrence. I think there are an awful lot of things that get folded into an admission decision, and the test, this will not have that result. It may feel like it on the outset, but people moving to test optional admission policies will almost assuredly not have the result of having more women enroll.
We go to Scott from Milwaukee next. And by the way, a couple lines are open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is our number. And our guest is Steve Syverson, Vice President for Enrollment at Lawrence University in Wisconsin. We're talking about college admission boards weighing SAT and ACT scores in their selection process. Lawrence, 3 years ago, went test optional. A number of other schools are looking at this for a number of reasons that we're discussing. What do you think? Should it be test optional? What have been your experiences with ACT and SAT? Is there an inherent unfairness about this? If you have money and you can take the test a lot of times and prep for the test as early as seventh grade, are you obviously, well, I would think you'd be at an advantage over someone who just simply can't afford to do that. Let's go to Scott from Milwaukee next. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Kathleen and Steve.
Hi.
Personal anecdote, just as an observation, I attended a small private school in the mid-90s and had my work study there in the admissions office, and had gotten to see a very interesting shift as the SAT and its administering board decided to go through their first recentering in what was said to be decades. The first year that I worked there, we had two people out of an incoming freshman class of several hundred that had scored a perfect 1600 on the SAT. Immediately following the recentering the next year, we saw that number go up to 45, and it sparked a very vigorous discussion among the admissions office there as to whether the test was going to be nearly as valid or even applicable as it had been previously, and if so, how to go about adjusting their own admission standards accordingly.
That sounds like more of a statement than a question for me to respond to.
I'm just looking for if... My part of it has been out for several years. Obviously, I'm quite a ways out of college, and I hadn't heard whether that had been observed at other colleges, whether there had been further recentering based on the board or anything like that.
Well, the board continues to evolve. Several years ago, and one of the reasons they added the writing test was that the University of California, which is their largest sort of single user of the tests, the chancellor was speculating that they didn't get enough information from the SAT. They might drop the requirement for the SAT, and one of his concerns was that it didn't effectively test sort of writing skills and that the UC system felt that they needed that. And, by golly, 2 years later, they introduced the writing test.
Uh-huh.
Obviously the College Board saw this major user of the SAT potentially pulling out and figured they better scramble and get this thing put together. So that's been the next evolution. They did the recentering, and then they did some tweaking with that, but then the next evolution was to add a writing component. So they now have three components to the SAT.
What is the writing component? Are you asked to do an essay?
Yep.
Really?
You have about 20 minutes, I think it is. I haven't taken it. About 20 minutes to write on a specific topic. And it underwent a lot of fire, and there are lots of schools that are not expressly using it now. Some are endorsing it, some are looking at it like we do, but don't really factor it in a big way. The ideal from this would be that as we worry about people having assistants writing their essays, You know, was their essay really written by the student, their application essay, or was it written by a parent or someone like that? Did they get it reworked in the English class? So there's been becoming an increasing concern over whether the writing that we see in the application is really the student's writing. So the idea of having a test, a controlled circumstance where the student doesn't know the question, the prompt for the essay in advance, is very appealing because then you're seeing their writing in that moment in time. The challenges to that portion of it focus on things like early on, someone at one of the schools out east said, hold up the essay that the student has written from across the room, and I'll tell you what score they probably got on it. And so there was a sense that if it was long enough, they got good scores.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
He was very accurate. It was scary how accurate he was in terms of being able to predict the scores. It's scored by a couple of readers, and there's another set of people who are concerned that if you use certain kinds of vocabulary and things, you can write an essay that gets scored well, even though the essay is not well written, you know, and because of the way the College Board has the scoring done. I think they're working through the process of trying to respond to those concerns of the early years, and that's why a lot of us are in a kind of a wait-and-see mode. You know, we'll see after this shakes down for a few years, we'll see whether they've worked the kinks out. But it is appealing to colleges, that idea. The other biggest challenge is this isn't the kind of essay or this isn't the kind of writing that students will do in college. So does it assess what we want to assess for college? To write for 20 minutes on a prompt that you had no thought about is very different than writing a substantive paper that's based on things that you've studied, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. We're talking this hour with Steve Syverson. He's vice president for enrollment at Lawrence University in Wisconsin. Over last weekend in Seattle, thousands of college admissions officials and also counselors from high school gathered to look at a number of issues. But one of the big presentations was the findings of the study of the use of standardized tests in undergraduate admission. At Lawrence, in an increasing number of schools across the country, although it's not a huge number yet, these tests are optional. He's been outlining the reasons why they are optional, how they predict future success in college and also in life. And we have yet to talk more with Steve, and we will, about what do they look at that will be a predictor of future success in college. What kinds of, is it grades in, do they look at special programs? Is it the year-long GPA, or is there another kind of test that students are taking? We'll talk with him more about that. We have a line or two open if you'd like to join the conversation. 800-486-8655 is the number. And you can send an email if you would like. That number is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to your phone calls now at 800-486-8655. Steve from Madison. Hi.
Hi. I just started listening a little while ago, but I understand the question has been asked. My daughter is a junior in high school now, and she's finally starting to take school seriously. She got a little blasé first few years, and you know, we kept telling her, you know, but well, she's finally getting it together, and I guess what I was wondering, doesn't the ACT help in a way for kids like my daughter who, you know, she's intelligent and she's starting to kick it into gear now, better late than ever, I guess, but that if she takes that, that would increase her chances of maybe getting into a school? And then I'll take my answer.
Okay. Thanks, Steve.
Sure. And the preponderance of schools out there are not test optional at this point, and the preponderance of schools still do pay substantial attention to the test scores. I think we all would look at things like that. When you're doing holistic reading, one of the things to recognize is that we are not monolithic as colleges in terms of how we do admission or what we're looking for, et cetera. And so I can't make any statement. No one can make a statement about colleges do this or do that or will place more or less emphasis on particular things because we're all doing it specific to our institutions. But in general, colleges will all tell you what you did in high school is a better indicator than what you did on the test on a weekend. You factor both things in. You look holistically at patterns. in the case of the caller's daughter, at a place like Lawrence where we're reading the whole folder, we would look at it, and if we saw a pattern that, you know, freshman, sophomore year grades weren't so hot, suddenly junior year there's an epiphany and the student is doing much better, and we'd probably wait to see that student's mid-year grades of their senior year to see if the trend continued. And if that was then confirmed with a strong score, so that you're looking at it and saying, okay, the pattern suggests that they didn't have their act together freshman, sophomore year, but in terms of the student who will walk in our door the following fall, if admitted, they're going to be just fine, then we would admit that student. And but the other side of it is that if you have a student who really doesn't do particularly well in school all the way through, a strong test score rarely will make the difference to gain admission. The test score is really typically kind of either confirming or potentially contradicting what we see in the high school transcript. And so for students who are applying to a test optional college, for instance, the ones who might choose to be non-submitters are those who have done really well in high school.
Yes.
And maybe their test score is inconsistent with that, you know, that it's a weaker test score. And so that would be the kind of student who's well served by a test optional kind of choice.
Tom from Tomahawk is next. Hi, Tom.
Hello. For about 15 years, I taught a graduate-level course in a college of education on tests. It was issues in education, and tests were part of the issues. And I'm retired now for some time, but going back 20, 30 years, there was an abundance of data showing how flawed these tests were. And there were incidents where bright high school kids would rip the tests apart, showing that that the answers that the people wanted were wrong. They even sued in one case and got a nice settlement from SAT people. What puzzles me is why people with such intelligence at universities even bother with these things. I hear what you're saying about it's one more little thing, but it's so flawed, I can't believe that they're still used. And I know they are, and people are up against the wall for selecting who's going to get in and get out. But anyway, that's my comment.
Thank you. Thanks for your comment, Tom. Steve?
I think they're much less flawed now than they were at an earlier point. And as I was commenting on the writing test, I think when they're first out of the gate, it's got more bugs in it than they care to have in it. I think that the agencies, both ACT and the College Board, have been very responsible and responsive in trying to address issues of, for instance, ethnic bias and gender bias and just bad testing. I think the whole production of these tests has evolved radically over the last 30 years. So I don't think that they're that flawed. They do have value. They have documented value in terms of predicting that early grade point average or academic sort of success in college. But the test, there's lots to hate about the tests. There really is. And lots of people, that's why there's so much fear, because lots of people have different kinds of complaints about why they're unfair or they're wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, the people who have great test scores don't tend to be complaining.
Right. And there's also something about test taking, I think, that makes many students extremely nervous. It's hard to think very clearly when you're really nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think?
Yes, absolutely. And there really are bad test takers out there.
Right.
There really are people who, there aren't as many as think there are bad test takers, because some of them just are not going to do well on any kind of test. But part of our concern, again, to reflect back to the commission, it's not really just colleges going test optional, but it's, are these the right tests? Do people who are using them at the colleges, and I would argue many, many, many of us in the profession, are not well enough versed in terms of the validity, the predictive validity for our particular college. Some colleges don't even run validity studies, and so they're really using a test and just making assumptions about how good an indicator they are. And that's part of what we're calling for with the commission report, is that colleges need to go back. They need to say, do we really need to do this? Does everybody need to do it just because everybody's doing it? Or can we say, well, yeah, it's not that critical. Some colleges, you know, Bill Fitzsimmons at Harvard, one of his pitches is they find much stronger correlation with the subject tests than with the SAT. And so if they were to move away, he's convinced they will continue to require tests, but they would much rather have subject tests because they correlate much better ultimately with graduation and things like that. So one of the recommendations of the report too is that we as a society look out there and say, are there tests that could be designed that are more aligned with the high school curriculum than the SAT and ACT?
Oh, that's interesting.
That the way to study for them is to study your courses in high school. That's how you're going to get a better score.
That makes sense.
Do
those kinds of tests exist now or not?
There are some. The subject tests would be pointed to as one. The IB curriculum, International Baccalaureate curriculum, that is becoming increasingly implemented here in the U.S. It used to be there were virtually none in the United States, and now there are an increasing number of schools. We have a number here in Wisconsin that have an IB program. It's a very rigorous, good program, and they have tests that are at the end. The AP exams, advanced placement exams, are good curricularly based tests, and a number of states have reasonably good state exit exams. And that's part of our concern about the SAT and ACT as well, is that they're being misused. They should never be used as the state assessment of, you know, which schools are doing better or worse and whether they're meeting curricular standards, because they aren't that aligned with the curriculum. They should never be used in rankings of colleges or rankings of high schools. They shouldn't be used for things like the National Merit Scholarship Qualifying, because it's used as a cut score, that it's just the score that makes the delineation on the front end. So there are lots of things out. The bond companies, Moody's, uses test scores at colleges to affect their bond rating for the colleges. I mean, those are just, that's not what the test was designed for. They're utter abuses of these tests.
Right. Thanks, Tom, for the call. Tina from La Crosse, hi.
Hi. I guess I'm really of two minds with what your guest is saying. I do understand that people who can put their child in from eighth grade onward and are studying and cramming and preparing would score better. And, I mean, I drug my own child twice, three times, to get a score. He's in a UW school now, and he was a good student, but he needed a bit of a kickstart to get the correct score. But on the other hand, I also taught at a junior college level and would meet, I taught in the EMT program, and people that were absolutely shocked at attendance and turning in paperwork, and that did absolutely nothing for your class grade. You had to have the correct answer and only the correct answer, and it was non-negotiable, non-explainable, or you failed. And you could repay and retake the course, but there were critical elements in EMT testing that were not negotiable. And then we also have two goddaughters in Texas who on paper were doing quite well in school, but you would look that they retook the classes they failed over the summer for a two-week cram course, and then were not failing and are going to graduate, one of them this year, graduate high school with a BC report card, and she's quite frankly functionally illiterate in both math, writing, and basically anything that you would consider academic, but her grades don't reflect it. She's a very nice child. She attends every day and turns in everything, but hasn't learned anything in 3 years. And that's scary. It's very scary. And she'll be devastated going into a college to find that they really aren't as interested. If you're a good child and you attend and you care, did you get the right answer on your algebra test? It's a yes or no answer.
Steve.
Well, and I think you're addressing one of the concerns that lots of us have, which is the quality of the and expectations in secondary education all the way, you know, it's K through 16 in a sense, that we've got issues all up and down the line. I don't believe that the SAT or the ACT is the way you affect curricular change or strengthening of curriculum in the high schools. Some people do feel that, you know, for that kind of case, that might reveal the fact that that student was not really prepared to take on college work. If the test were more aligned with the curriculum, it would certainly reveal that in spades. But at a school like a Lawrence, where we're reading holistically anyway, we would be able to figure out that she'd taken the summer school courses and that's where she was picking up grades that were pulling them up from, you know, failing grades. So I don't really worry about that kind of student in our selection process, at least. If a school is crunching numbers and just looking at a GPA and the test score, then obviously the test score would tend, probably, you presume that, would tend to reveal that she wasn't really prepared to go on.
Thank you, Tina, for your call. We go to Dan from Reedsburg next. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Very interesting show. My oldest daughter is a senior this year, so we're going through the application process as we speak. And luckily, she's had pretty good test scores. But I definitely understand where you're coming from, that it should be questioned if that's the best measure of everything. I guess a few specific questions. I wondered if there's an advantage or disadvantage when applicant, like one of the schools on her list is Lawrence, and
Great.
She would be right around the 50 percentile mark of applicants there in her test scores.
Uh-huh.
If you're at that level, is there any disadvantage to submitting your test, or is it only if you have a lower test score? And I wondered also if you see a difference in graduation rates between, say, somebody with an ACT of 25 versus 32.
Mm.
First of all, we haven't had any graduates who have come through under the test optional yet because we've only been test optional for 3 years. I think that there's no disadvantage to us. One of the things that is interesting about having gone test optional is we've always read holistically. We've always placed the greatest emphasis on the high school record. And so even if someone submitted a lower test scores, they rarely were so problematic that they would cause us to deny a student who otherwise would have been admitted. And so I would certainly argue that no, and especially if someone's in the middle of our class, that's never going to be a disadvantage to submit them. It really is whether the student feels they represent them well. We've had several students in the time we've been test optional, we've had several students who had 35 ACTs who chose not to submit them because they felt that, you know, these test scores don't really represent who I am. I'm a good student. I'd rather have you not look at them, you know, that they like the philosophy so much. So a variety of people are attracted to the program. It really didn't change the way we read folders essentially at all. We've always placed much more emphasis. And so if your daughter's done well in school, you can choose to submit them or not submit them, and it probably won't make a lot of difference in terms of the outcome from our end.
Okay.
Okay, Dan?
All right, sounds good.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Alfonso from Madison. Hi, Alfonso.
Hi. Just have a quick comment about my experience. I happen to think that a lot of kids that come from disadvantaged backgrounds have very little experience with SATs and ACTs and very often don't even know anything about them. And my personal experience, I remember being called into the library once when I was in high school, and I was told that I was going to take the SAT, and I had no idea what it was. And my scores weren't very good. I was also in the process of learning English, and that was another hit. I think a lot of kids simply whose parents don't understand the system or who come from backgrounds where the families don't emphasize that, even though they may be good students, just simply don't do well. And then it's not really their fault or the fact that they're, not intelligent enough to do well in coursework or enter universities. I later learned that a lot of my friends at the high school that were more affluent had been test-taking for practice since they were in elementary school and they were going to special schools to study for that. So they were very close to getting perfect scores by the time they were in 9th or 10th grade. And, you know, there are other kids like me that had never seen the test and never learned how to take a test. So we were at a pretty big disadvantage.
I'm sure you were, yeah.
That's absolutely one of the concerns that there are. Mm. And increasingly in the United States, we have non-native speakers of English.
Mm-hmm.
And within the college admission community, because we have lots of very successful graduates of our colleges who were non-native speakers of English at the outset, and our country has benefited greatly by many, many immigrants who were non-native speakers and who have contributed immensely to society later on in life. And so the colleges are struggling with this, trying to figure out how do you take advantage of and take care of this rather large population and an increasing population of non-native speakers. Because if they take this early on in their tenure in terms of learning English and they take the test, clearly they'll have lower scores, certainly on the verbal sorts of portions of it.
And thanks so much for your call. Steve, what an informative hour and interesting one, too. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me. Sorry, David did get plugged in here.
I don't know where he was. Yeah. He just never called us back, so yeah. I don't know where he is. I'll have to give him some grief here. Yeah, okay. Do that. Thank you. Thanks. Syverson, our guest, Vice President for Enrollment at Lawrence University in Wisconsin, who did the show himself. We were to have had the Director of Public Policy for the National Association for College Admission Counseling, but TT just didn't answer the phone. So thank you, Rhonda Fanning, for producing this hour, Katie Madsen for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And we want to remind you that Maya Angelou will be with us tomorrow during this time period, a special guest, and she has written a new book, Letter to My Daughter. She, of course, has written a number of wonderful books, and she's a terrific talk show guest. So she will be with us tomorrow during this hour. You may want to mark that down. And the first hour, we'll be looking more at the financial bailout and at the presidential race and previewing the vice presidential debate, which is to be held tomorrow night. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Thanks so much for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.